So, no, actually, this is going to be very flexible. If I only get three slides in before everybody inundates me with questions, that's fine. We can go off on any direction you want to. But this is the animal I'm going to talk about today, bees. Bees are wonderful. We heard a little bit about fruit flies, and we all know about fruit flies. Bees are wonderful models, as you'll see, for learning and memory and doing neuroscience, electrophysiological recordings, bioimaging. Bees are very social, so any aspect of their social biology, which is in large part driven by odors, that queen with the tag on her back produces a very powerful pheromone that these bees are looking to pick up and distribute through the colony, so the entire colony knows they still indeed have a queen. We can breed honeybees. I won't tell you anything about honeybee breeding today. Suffice it to say, anything I tell you about learning, you can select for genetic lines of bees that differ. So there's genetic variation out there that we can take advantage of and have. And we have a rudimentary ability to make now transgenic bees. But I'm going to limit what I say to this idea of speed and plasticity. And because
actual questions, how many neurons is a bee supposed to have?
Just under a million in their brains. So about 10 times as many as fruit flies, and about 10 million times fewer than we have in our brains. I always like to tell people a colony with 100,000 bees in it has the neural capacity of a large primate. It's just they're connected differently. Let me give you the take-home messages, because I've already seen, and Venky's warned me, we may not get more than three slides in. And that's when we present bees with an odor. And I think this is true of any animals. I think Dima Rinberg, when he comes here, will show you some data. That they make very, very fast decisions about the odor when it comes on. And I'll show you some data that it's within a few hundred milliseconds. The bees starting a behavioral response. But they make continuous evaluation of the odors even while they're responding. And one of the things that's interested me over the years is plasticity. Every time we stick an electrode into a new area of a bee's brain, or we load calcium dye fura into a different area, we see some kind of plasticity. So the plasticity, not like the memory, as I'm sure you all know, is located in one place. It's rather distributed. So I think a big problem is how do these distributed forms of plasticity interact with each other? And this distributed plasticity is going to be important for these decisions. First, a little bit more about the bee brain. So I was anticipating Venky's questions. About a million neurons. Plasticity is distributed, and certain types of biogenic amines are key components to reinforcement pathways. Back when I was a postdoc with Randolph Menzel, back in the mid-1980s, they discovered this particular neuron. So if you could take this part of the brain and overlay it on this picture, you'll see this is a huge neuron that has its cell body back here in this neuropil behind and below the brain. And it's a cluster of neurons. I'm just showing one right here, and they're called ventral unpaired medial cells because the cell body lies right on the midline of the brain, so they're not paired on either side. They're not bilaterally paired. This particular one sends neurites that arborize all over the brain. Here in the mushroom bodies, which many of you may have heard with fruit flies, certainly are considered the important loci for learning and memory, and they are in the bees as well. But something that interested me also back when Randolph and colleagues discovered this neuron was you see branches that come down here and they arborize in practically every area or glomerulus of the antennal lobe. This neuron receives input from sucrose-sensitive taste receptors on the brain, so you can see that it's positioned as a modulatory neuron that whenever the bee is fed reinforcement, this neuron is activated and literally rains down a biogenic amine called octopamine all over the brain. So that's a signal that's learned whatever just happened or just occurred because it's associated with something good. And there's very good evidence now that this neuron drives that.
So I have a question. Is the dopaminergic neuron respond to sugar is highly selective? respond to many other things.
You know, I don't think, in this VUM neuron, is it selective to sucrose?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it's only been tested with a few sugars, and I don't know how selective it is, or if it responds to water. I don't think it responds to water, but it's mostly sweet taste sensation. But I don't know how ubiquitous it is for many different kinds of sugars.
Yeah, because in fly, that, like some of the dopaminergic neurons that you able to show you that respond to sugar, but they haven't tested the many other chemicals.
Yeah, I'll show a picture of dopamine here in a minute, at least what it's doing in the antennal lobe. And if you're referring to what Scott Waddell's talking about with dopamine interacting with octopamine, I don't necessarily agree completely with what Scott's talking about. We can talk about that later if you like. So one thing that interested me at the time was...
is there a flip? Is there an inversive? Is there a modulatory agent that's given off that...
For aversive stimuli? Well, supposedly that's dopamine, although there's some controversy right now as to the role of dopamine. The old story was octopamine is appetitive, dopamine is aversive, so you can use electroshock to condition honeybees.
Are the dopamine neurons, do they have a similar pattern of...
No.
They overlap?
In fact, nope. I'll get past this slide, which is my central question of... This is my focus, is what's the plasticity doing here, and show you the next slide, which, as a matter of focus here, if you look within the glomeruli, these are glomeruli in the same sense that flies have glomeruli, that vertebrates, including humans, have glomeruli in their olfactory bulbs. The distribution of biogenic amines is different within a glomerulus. And here you can see this is anti-octopamine. I'm sorry if you can't read those labels. This is anti-octopamine that is in the cortex around the outer edges of the glomerulus. And it's releasing octopamine there.
So that each of the blobby thing is at one glomerulus then?
Here?
Yeah.
This is
what is the glomerulus spatial scale there?
Pardon?
Show us one glomerulus.
Oh.
No, there. In parallel.
Oh, here. This is one glomerulus right here. Sorry.
Yep.
And it's subdivided into two regions, functionally. There's the outer cortex. All of the sensory neurons, the sensory axons, terminate in the outer cortex. You have axons of local inhibitory GABAergic interneurons terminating there. You have dendrites of projection neurons interacting with this area of the glomerulus. Okay, so you can see that whatever octopamine is targeting out here.
In the middle
is the core, and what you see in the middle, the picture is maybe not projecting as well. If you can take this and project it onto this, these are the olfactory receptor axon terminals, right? And as I said, they're in the cortex. This is a projection neuron coming in and spreading its dendrites throughout this entire glomerulus. So what's in the core is the projection neurons mostly, as well as some...
Dendrites.
Pardon?
Dendrites.
Dendrites of projection. Cell bodies are far away. That's correct.
And is there a ring of juxtaglomerular interneurons like there is in the vertebrate?
Yes, there are at least two different types of GABAergic interneurons, probably more. One of them has arborizations. This is one of them right here, and you can see it arborizes throughout the entire glomerulus.
And the cell bodies are like in a ring around the borders?
Cell bodies, or? No, not around the glomerulus. The cell bodies are in a cluster somewhere else, and they'll send a projection into all the 160-odd glomeruli.
So the answer is no.
Yes.
The point is that cell bodies are not around that. They're always in
it. Right.
But
yes.
They're also multiglomerular and not uniglomerular.
They're also uniglomerular.
Oh, they are.
That's right. And they're also uniglomerular, multiglomerular projection neurons. I'm sorry I don't have the whole wiring diagram here, but you have these projection neurons. They're called uniglomerular projection neurons. We talked about a little bit last week, I think, in Mathieu's talk. And you have multiglomerular projection neurons that have dendrites in just about every glomerulus and then project their axons to the lateral protocerebrum, different targets from these guys, and they're GABAergic. Okay?
And you said the inhibition is also similarly to the uniglomerular or multiglomerular?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Are those two different species of interneurons, or the same species of interneurons?
Two different types of interneurons. And I say two, knowing that there are probably more.
I'm more curious, they're also optic glomeruli, right? Also, I'm not sure in the bee, but in the fly, you have optic glomeruli. Do they look very similar? Or the
optical glomeruli, you mean? For in the optical? I don't know the extent to, I don't know the visual system of bees as well. There are, when you get up into the mushroom bodies, which I'm not going to get into, up here, you'll see that the axons of these projection neurons terminate in what are called microglomeruli, where there's a lot of local synaptic connectivity between the different types of intrinsic and extrinsic fibers that come into the mushroom bodies. So this glomerular organization extends beyond the antenna lobe. I guess that's the take-home message. And it wouldn't surprise me if there are glomeruli in the optic lobes over here, one or more of the regions.
Is there a general model of why the glomerulus works? I mean, why is it such a common structure across sensory systems?
Why is it common across sensory systems?
Glomeruli.
If there's optical.
Not in the vertebrate.
I think the optical glomeruli are completely different. It's not like the same type of thing.
No, that's my question.
Well, I said glomerular organization, something about clustering of synaptic connectivity.
Different spatial scales, different convergence.
Yes, in different areas of the brain, there could be very different reasons for it to exist.
In primates, there are glomerular columns.
But within the olfactory system, is. Why glomerulus? Is this something that you guys all figured out last week?
Oh, yeah, we got
it. It's a secret.
Yeah, it's over.
My great idea is that there's a glutamate spillover, and glomeruli, they kind of preserve glutamate from, you know, interfering with other glomeruli. I mean, the structure, basically.
Yeah, because they're surrounded by glial cells. And these glomeruli are also surrounded by glial cells. So it's this sort of like compartmentalization of the circuitry.
Isn't there a more basic reason that you have many receptors for the same molecule, so you sort of want to collect the signal together? I mean, that's just sort of basic signal processing.
No, but they go to different glomeruli.
Like, it doesn't have to be cells. He's
talking about cells of the same kind.
Cells of the same kind go to the same glomeruli. That's right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right, but you need to gather the signal anyway.
Right.
So you might as well. And then if you don't gather them spatially and you have them distributed everywhere, you have to run lots of wires and whatnot all over the place. That's more complicated. It seems easier this way.
So but then you want bounds because the neighboring glomeruli are not necessarily related to each other, so you don't want to tolerate slop in cross.
Well, that would be the case even if you did it non-spatially. Then you'd have lots of neurons around you that were.
No. What you said is correct first. You converge. But you would converge like thalamus to visual cortex, where you don't make glomeruli. You make a continuous map.
Okay.
You don't want to make a continuous map because nearest neighbors don't mean anything.
Fair enough.
So you need a boundary. Then you need Alexi's
explanation. Okay.
Yeah, so you have the boundary which is formed by the glial cells that isolates neighboring glomeruli, so you don't get this confusion across
the
crosstalk. So all I wanted to say here was the way biogenic amines are working. This is octopamine in the cortex interacting with the ORNs as well as with the other circuitry there, the interneurons. This is serotonin releasing all throughout the glomerulus. This is dopamine. Dopamine processes don't enter the glomeruli, but instead they surround the glomerulus on the outside. Okay? I don't know what all that means, but just that's something we're starting to look at right now. What is the role of these different amines? Because they spatially are certainly segregated in the antenna lobe. But I'm going to mostly talk about octopamine when I talk about biogenic amines. One thing, octopamine, I'm going to tell you a lot about plasticity. And let me give you the sort of bottom line about that right now. Plasticity in the antenna lobe is driven putatively by the release of at least octopamine. And we've got some very good evidence that, and I won't go into it so much, that there are octopamine receptors on the GABAergic processes in the antenna lobe. So if you want to modify the antenna lobe in ways that, if I get to it, I'll show you, we can happen, modifying the inhibition is a very powerful rule, and we've repeated that computationally with models with Maxime and Ramon and others to show that that's what you want to do. But I want to spend some time now talking about behavior. As I said, a big advantage to the honeybee is that you can train the bee using any number of conditioning paradigms. And if any of you want to bet me a very nice bottle of wine about some kind of conditioning paradigm, I just haven't lost yet, let's put it that way. You can do a lot of very impressive things with a bee in a restrained situation. Now, you can train a free-flying bee, but if you want to do any kind of controlled learning study where you control the stimulation and the relationship between a CS and a US, if you then want to go in and invasively do any kind of recording of what's going on in the brain, you have to bring them into this situation where you're putting the bee in a small harness, you're triggering an odor to blow across its antennae, which, as you know, are the bee's nose. And the light here means the odor's coming on. The bee can't see red. This is down below the bee, so this is just a signal that the odor's coming on. This bee has been well trained to expect sucrose reinforcement when the odor comes on. And you can see the odor comes on, and the bee sticks its proboscis out, which is this structure, which if you could look at the side of its head, it would be folded underneath like this. And when the bee extends it, it comes out. And that's the conditioned response. And you see, the bee is very expressive also with its antennae, so there's a lot of information you can get out of these simple kinds of behavior. I will say simpler kinds of behaviors.
So what are the possible side effects of restraint? Because, you know, in mammals, theta rhythm, for example, shuts down in the male hippocampus when they're restrained. So what has anyone done that absolute parallel restraint, non-restraint, or stress effects? I'm just curious, like, is there something going on?
No, I don't think anybody studied this systematically, except there have been a few studies where when something comes into bloom outside, and everybody who trains bees knows this, when something comes into bloom, any naturally occurring odor and nectar source is a very powerful stimulus for a bee. They love it. Right when this tree comes into bloom, the bees in the laboratory stop learning very well. But if you get that odor from outside and bring it in and put it in our olfactory apparatus, they respond beautifully to it. So that's a case. I mean, there's a whole interesting side story to that, but that's a case where you bring bees from outside a natural situation where they've learned something and they express it inside.
In terms of the neural processing of the odor when they're restrained versus when they're released, like they're walking on a ball versus restrained.
Nobody's really ever looked at that, although I think Randolph Menzel now has an ability to put these long tethered electrodes on bees while they're walking. Mm-hmm. But certainly flying is almost out of the question.
Has anyone looked at the 3D structure of the movement of the antenna?
Yes, a few people have. In fact, we're starting to do that because, like I said, you can see the bees waving its antennae around.
Really,
and the odor comes on, and suddenly it's here. And one of the things I think that the bee is doing, if you watch what they're doing, they're moving their antennae rapidly, and I think that's almost the equivalent of sniffing. Mm-hmm. There's a boundary layer around that antenna, dead air. And I think what they're trying to do is enhance the ability of getting the odor across that boundary layer, which is something I'm going to talk a lot about here in a few minutes.
Can you tell us a little bit about the history of bees and this olfactory kind of plasticity task? So was there, in the beginning, when Menzel's group was thinking about doing this, like a systematic comparison of lots of insects that could be used, and or was it always sort of gravitation to try this kind of thing in bees and it worked really well?
There was a gravitation to try it in bees because of the history with Carl von Frisch. And you know, he's the one who, 100 years ago now, discovered the dance language. And he has a whole history of 50 years beyond that of research that included a lot of research on olfaction and floral odors. So the whole German school was very, not the whole, but a lot of people were influenced by that, so they naturally gravitated toward the bee because of the ability to detect many different odors and the ability to learn about those odors. So I think the bee sort of had an in as far as the behavior went. and there was a natural gravitation there. Now, of course, there were other insects that were used at the time, including fruit flies, and if you want to do genetics, the fruit flies are a far better animal than the bee. But the bee, their ability to learn, it's interesting, there was one of the graduate students, his name was Varishi, in 1970, in the early late 60s, he was one of the first people to train bees to odors, and he thought, well, let me just sit down and train bees to as many different pairs of odors, differential training, plus minus, as I can, and find out what they can't discriminate. And I read his thesis, and he had something like 1,000 different pairs of odors, and he spent years training large groups of bees to discriminate all these pairs of odors, and his basic conclusion was they can do it all. I think my graduate students sometimes have accused me of putting them on impossible tasks, but I mean, that was really amazing. So they're very, very good at it. Not only that, but they can learn something one day, they'll remember it the next day, but you can train them to something else the next day. So they're very, very flexible in that way. So that's what attracted people to the bee, I think.
Can they do location setting and blocking and things like that?
Yeah, done it all. Argue with people a lot about it. We've done blocking with odors. I can train a bee to not like sucrose, so if odor A comes on, they feed on sucrose fine. Odor B comes on, and in that context, you touch their antennae with sucrose, and if they extend their proboscis, they get a shock. And they learn very quickly, it's okay to feed in the context of A, but they avoid even sucrose in the context of B.
This is what's called blocking?
No, that's called signaled avoidance.
So what's blocking?
Blocking, if you train a bee to a mixture of two things, let's say A and X, and then afterwards you ask them, what did they learn about A, what did they learn about X when they're trained together? You'll find that they learn a little bit less well than when they're trained to pure A or pure X, because there's some kind of interference in the mixture that can be many different forms. Blocking is when I pre-train the bees to odor A, then I train them to AX, and the control is obviously B versus AX, and then I learn they learn a lot less about X because A is very salient, so it biases the perception of the mixture. So A blocks X in that regard. So yes, we've done all of that. And we've also done physiological studies with blocking in the antenna lobe, which Fernando will go into, I think, in a month when he's here. So a little bit about the learning. You give them a real simple learning task, learn this odor. In this case, they're learning decanal, a 10-carbon aldehyde, and this is trial 1, trial 2, trial 3, trial 4. Each trial is separated by about 6 minutes. Very few of the bees, some of them respond a little bit to the odor on the first trial, but after this association on the second trial, already 80% are responding. And it gets up to, this was a good day where we trained 100% of the bees successfully. And this is a group of about 20 bees. So they learn that very quickly. Afterwards, we test them with decanal, 8-carbon aldehyde, 6-carbon aldehyde. There's some generalization decrement when we switch it to a ketone and change the carbon chain length, you see more. So you can establish these nice generalization gradients, which are great if you're trying to go into the central nervous system and asking questions about odor coding.
So with A, it's not that these bees were previously tested at different odors. This is the first time they've ever been tested at odor association.
In the laboratory,
that's what I mean.
Right, yes.
So literally one trial, like two trials, maybe.
Yeah. It's not always that good, as I'm about to show you, because a lot of times we're trying to put bees in a situation where the learning's difficult for them.
What's the performance of different concentrations happening?
Of different concentrations after we train them to A?
They responded to the
A was the reduced concentration.
So if we train them to the reduced concentration?
Train them with one concentration.
And then lower the concentration. They generalize from high training to low less well than low training to high testing.
Okay.
right? And there's some kind of gain control going on quite clearly in the olfactory system. So when the things around me are very high concentration, I can tune down the olfactory system a little bit. And I think that's what it reflects. It could be these biogenic amines, some of the other ones, serotonin, dopamine, that are released that are doing this gain control. I don't know what it is.
And the people question is that, can you train the bee to recognize the sequence of order, like A first and B second, plus B first, A second?
No. People have tried that unsuccessfully, although I'm going to show something not quite that, but related to that a little bit with the sequential. But I don't think it's been successful to say A, B, reward, B, A, no reward. I don't think people have done that yet. Okay, a lot of times we want to make it really tough for the bee. We don't want to make it really easy, particularly when we're looking at learning and trying to track that into a change in the brain of representation. So here, for example, this is, we're training, the open circles here are 9 parts one odor, 1 part another, followed by reward. The closed circles are just the opposite, 1, 9 followed by nothing. So it's discrimination training now of mixtures. Furthermore, they're mixtures at a low concentration. So these are 2 things that make it tough for the bee. And in contrast to what I just showed you, you can see the bees here, they learn, they start to respond to the CS+. They respond also to the CS-, which they shouldn't, and it takes them a while, and then they get out here, and this is what I call the aha effect, where eventually, after enough learning trials, the bees act as though they say, okay, I get it. And they can discriminate. They can do it. I think Ramon and I called it the aha effect in a paper. And
so, would you?
No, that was me, so it was my fault. The reviewers didn't. Yeah.
You would have called it Eureka, but yeah.
Yeah, that's even better, Eureka.
So, Brian, maybe you're going to get to this something, but I think whenever I see these things, it's not that these cannot discriminate in the beginning, it's just that they don't know what the hell you want them to do, right?
That's right, they're figuring it out. So one thing I want to segue now that I've shown you the learning, I put this in here to remind me to segue to some other things. And these are the 2 messages, decisions are fast and evaluation is continuous. And I thought it would be interesting to show you actually some videos of the behavioral responses, if I can find my video.
Is this faster than a Drosophila would learn?
It's hard to say. Because of the way fruit flies are assayed. I've been over in Germany this year and will be back in a couple months trying to train fruit flies, and I approached that with some trepidation. But I found, to their credit, fruit flies are really good at learning. It's hard to titrate out the effect of trial. Harder with fruit flies than it is with bees.
Are you using the same
paradigm
with
proboscis extended? No, we're using the T-maze that we heard about last week. Where, you know, you test for 2 minutes and you don't know, is do the fruit flies segregate immediately or do they run back and forth, and it's a game of musical chairs until you pull the elevator up and so many are on this side and so many are on that side. So it's a little difficult to compare with flies in that regard.
But couldn't you use the same paradigm? That would work.
Actually, my colleague Giovanni Galizia over in Konstanz is doing exactly that to make it a little bit more comparable.
With the bee?
With the bee.
But it's less imprecise, right? You have less control.
Well, there are reasons you would want to do that.
He's doing the T-maze with the bees?
The equivalent of a T-maze with the bees.
It seems like you want to do the other way. You want to be more precise,
right?
With flies.
Right.
Well, actually, no, the reason you would want to do it, and there's some interesting things about a T-maze. I said they're running back and forth. Something that people have not established with bees in a controllable setting is whether they have a sense of short time intervals. Which, when you're running back and forth in a maze, you can establish. In other words, does a bee know when 5 seconds has gone by, or 30 seconds, or a minute? And I think that's a real interesting approach that you can use with these T-mazes. It's more difficult to use here, because you don't have as much spontaneous behavior here as you do in a T-maze.
And why don't you do proboscis extension in the other fly?
In the fly? That's hard. People have done it. just to restrain the fly and touch the tarsal sucrose receptors. It works, but I don't know why people don't do it more.
It is that you would not have the ground for comparison with the
In some sense, you would, yes, right.
If Rachel Wilson and Glenn Turner can do this fancy imaging and patch pandemonium,
I mean, people have done it. Ron Davis, you know, had fruit flies fixed under a 2-photon microscope, I think, or a confocal, where he could actually train an individual fly in that situation. And it's very tedious work, though.
Didn't Glenn show something the other day?
I don't remember if he...
Glenn Turner showed his, the tube dissemination, right?
Yeah, I don't know if he was doing individual flies at that point. Could have been.
Oh, maybe not. Maybe the behavior wasn't teenage. Okay, never mind. Sorry.
So it's tarsus extension in Drosophila?
No, it's proboscis extension, but they have tarsal sucrose receptors.
So they
said, Bees have tarsal sucrose receptors too, but they also have them on the antenna and on the mouth part.
Huh.
So.
But Drosophila don't have sucrose on the antenna.
As far as I know, they don't, although I have to be a little careful saying that. They certainly have it on the proboscis.
They do.
But their antennae are so tiny, you could never get a droplet of sucrose that close to the fly without drowning it.
Yes, the
fly do have pseudoreceptors in their antennae. In fact, not just one pseudoreceptor. I think all of the pseudoreceptors are found in the antennae. That was published this year.
All the different types of receptors are found on the antennae, but then they're also found on the tarsal. Right. What I'd like to do is just take a second and talk a little bit about speed. This is that video you just saw. And what you see as the line moves across here, this is the antennal position. But this line means the light comes on. This line means the proboscis is extended. With my glasses now, run this forward to right when the light comes on. Right there, that's the video frame with the light on. The light comes on means the valve open, and then it takes about 10 or 15 milliseconds for the odor to get to where the bee's positioned. So now, if I just go forward a frame at a time and count, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12, and there you just saw the mandible start to move. That's the start of a response. You see that? Mandibles are opening. That was 12 video frames, about 350 milliseconds, right? So this bee's made that decision that fast. And right now, that's our cue for the proboscis coming out, and that's when we score it. That's about 600 milliseconds in. But remember that proboscis is folded underneath here, so by the time it gets here, the bee's already been extending it for maybe 100 milliseconds. So it's an overestimate of the latency. But now, and these are some very, very, I dredged up a lot of really old stuff for this talk, so I hope you don't mind. And I published, and you can see from the timestamp, 1996, when I made these animated GIFs, and this was hot technology back then, okay? I keep thinking I haven't made it into a movie. But these are different kinds of behavioral responses. So in all of these bees, both of these bees, they respond. So if you're scoring at 1-0, you'd say response. But I just want to show you how...
It takes some time to upload that.
It's 3 megabytes.
In the technology of 1996, yes. That was a warning on my website. This is a response very much like what you just saw. Odor comes on. This is the light here with the odor. The bee has a nice, vigorous response, right? And that, I think we'd all say, is a good response. Now, there's another bee. That's it. No. All right. Severe. I call this indecisiveness in a paper. Another word I'd like to use the reviewers don't like. But you see two very different response topologies right there. And this is part of, for me, saying speed, a few hundred milliseconds to make a decision and get to a motor output once the odor hits the antenna. And This bee was clearly, in my mind, evaluating the odor continuously, even after it started to respond, where it said, well, no, that's not it. Well, yes, it is. No, it's not. And you can see these kinds of responses quite frequently.
Does the bee have any particular advantage of responding quickly in this case to get more total reward? Or?
Well, the next two slides, I went back to some data that are now 6 or 7 years old the other day. When I got in my mind last week, I should talk about speed, and I pulled up a bunch of latency data that we didn't put in the paper back then. And so if you plot now the latencies, and this is three different groups of bees. There are about 80 bees in this graph. It's a nice thing about bees, by the way. Whenever I give a talk to a psych department, I say we have about 100 colonies, and each has 100,000 bees, so we have about 10 million research subjects that do pretty well at taking care of themselves. But there's a lot of bees here, and what I plotted here was just the frequency distribution of bees that showed different latencies. So this is 100 milliseconds, 200, 300, 400, 500, 600, so just binned them by 100 milliseconds. And these bees, three different groups, one was trained to a 200 millisecond pulse of odor. Odor comes on, 200 milliseconds later, it's off. You get a reward. The other group, another group was 500 milliseconds. The third group was 1,000. And you can see the median values are right about there, somewhere around 500 or 600 milliseconds. But the fastest bees are going to be in the 300 to 400 millisecond range, and that's to get the proboscis out to where we can see it. So realistically, it's 200 to 300 milliseconds, okay? From odor on, sensory transduction, get through the brain, get processed, I recognize the odor, that's it, initiate a motor response. That's extremely fast.
How can you rule out that there are differences in the experimental setup, the time it takes for the odor to reach the antennae or different bees, and that could explain the distribution?
It's possible it could. And actually, I'll show you a little bit of an olfactometer we developed recently, because looking at these data, it made me think there's a real interesting question here that reflects a little bit of, so we have to control it better. But we had one group of bees that's not on here yet. That group of bees, and it was trained in parallel to these, and that group of bees was trained with 2,000 milliseconds of stimulus, and that's what that one looks like. Now we're shifting a little bit to a longer latency. What I'm beginning to wonder is if did these bees learn that they have more time and therefore took more time to evaluate the odor to reach some kind of decision. That I don't know. But the general message, the take-home message is that the first few hundred milliseconds are really important for decisions about odors. Not what's happening at 1 second or 2 seconds, but probably within 100 to 150 milliseconds.
So somebody had a question. Not to get into all the nitty-gritty. I mean, in mouse, during the recent year, people are rediscovering some of this stuff. There's all this worry about the trials coming at fixed intervals, and then some sort of predictive, like, you know, it's every 5 seconds or so, versus sort of exponentially distributed, unpredictable. These are repeated trials.
Repeated trials at fixed intervals of 6 minutes.
6 minutes?
Yes.
Okay, so this is a long time, and they have really no idea when it's coming.
Right, but this is, looking at these data now, inspired by all of our discussions last week, it made me think, well, there's some interesting experiments we could be doing here to see what do the bees know when they have different lengths of time to make these decisions.
Yeah, it's interesting. How far can you push it to smaller time scales? So
pardon?
What's the minimum amount of time you have to expose the bee to in order to make it recognize
it? Well, 200 milliseconds works beautifully. You know, we could get it down with our new olfactometer down to sub 50 milliseconds if we wanted to. And I think I'm probably going to go home and find a graduate student to do this.
I was wondering if you could, I noticed the one that was indecisive. There was a lot of movement of the body, actually, and the back legs in particular. It seemed like it was out of sync with the proboscis. And I wonder if the indecisive means that they're not sure, so they're actually trying to move their body to get another sample, or, I mean.
Possibly. I mean, we sort of keep that to a minimum now because we can restrain the bee completely. More than we did, that was last century.
Oh, okay, okay, yeah. But it's interesting, I mean, but actually releasing them and showing them, you know, it'd be interesting to see if you get individual differences that are related to how they're sampling.
Yeah, individual differences, absolutely, you see.
Yeah,
you can select genetic lines based on these differences, and that's a whole nother interesting story down the road, right?
Do the latency distributions look different on false alarm trials, or they're incorrect?
I have those data. I didn't get time to plot them. I'll show them to you tomorrow. But I think the median latencies are going to be about 600 milliseconds, but I think they're going to shift a little bit to the right for the CS minus. I had these all plotted. My computer crashed before I saved it yesterday. Had to reboot and just had time to do this. So to sort of summarize some things I've been saying, this is sort of in general about insects, you know, across insects and vertebrates. You see very similar, lots of similarities in coding that we know about, cross-fiber coding in the periphery, the sensory cells. It's similar in insects and mammals. You have differences in mechanism, G protein-coupled receptors versus ionotropic receptors or putatively ionotropic receptors in insects. And I always like to put this on the first page of my grant proposal to NIH, and I always have to take it out in a revision, that what this seems to indicate is the range of neural coding for odors may be the range of solutions to the olfactory problem may be limited to one or a few, but the fact that insects and mammals accomplish it with very different sensory coding schemes, I mean, sensory transduction schemes, means that they've converged on the same problem. And evolutionarily, if you want to say that some kind of functional mechanism is important, look at convergence. Because if you're converging on the same solution, it might mean that you're limited to a very narrow range of solutions, given that you have to do it with neurons. But I always like to say, this is where I point out that we know a lot about the solution to the olfactory problem, but a little bit about the conundrum of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. You know the answer to the ultimate question in the universe, but you don't know what the question is, right? So what's the problem? I say that a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but I want to go out to start looking at the problem, and the two parts of the problem I'm going to talk about here, maybe in the next 37 minutes, is variation. Variation from multiple sources. So if you start to ask a sensory system, why is it organized a certain way? You can't ask that unless you understand what it has evolved to detect in the environment and the statistical structure of the environment that it's operating in. And this is what it looks like for odors. If you, and here we put some titanium chloride on these flowers on a balcony at night, and you can see as the titanium chloride comes off these flowers, it quickly breaks up into these thin, wispy little filaments because of turbulence. And this isn't air turbulence. This is only thermal turbulence right now. If you add air turbulence, it makes it even more complicated. If you put a detector somewhere downwind, you would pick up little spikes of odors when one of these filaments happens to cross the detector. And in this kind of a situation, if you think of an animal like a bee or a moth flying upwind and these filaments moving downwind, the animal might only be exposed to a filament when it crosses it for a few milliseconds at most. So the transduction must be fast. And insects have evolved this wonderful behavioral strategy for solving this problem of a turbulent filamentous structure of an odor plume, that is to locate the source. This is a wind tunnel. This is about 4 feet across, or 5 feet across, and this is about 8 or 9 feet in length. There's a fan blowing air from right to left, and there's an odor source here that this moth has been trained to locate, or trained to recognize, and the moth is right here. And I'm going to play this in a second, and actually, Well, you were saying this moth was trained while it was tied down, and we just released it in a wind tunnel.
Okay.
And watch what it does when it gets a whiff of the odor. Classic behavioral strategy. You catch one of those filaments, you surge upwind, you go for a while without catching another filament, you fly crosswind until you catch another filament, surge upwind, and this combination of casting with surges is a very efficient way of locating that point source for an odor right there.
What happens when you enter the filaments? Do they casting, they enter the filaments, or do you have a stereotype response there? That
it's a surge upwind. They enter a filament, and they...
But you mentioned they'll enter the filament obliquely from the side, most likely.
Then they turn upwind.
They turn
upwind. Yes, positive anemotaxis.
Okay.
Right? You get your filament, it's not likely crosswind or downwind, so just hit upwind. So you have very simple behavioral rules. You catch a filament, fly upwind, catch another filament, keep going. You don't catch one, start flying crosswind till you catch one, and then go upwind.
Is there anyone who's actually visualized the filaments and the behavior at the same time?
Gela atoma, people have done it in odor plumes in the water.
Right? Yeah.
That's harder to do here.
Yeah.
I don't know of anybody who's actually... Oh, well...
Because I'm just wondering how plastic that casting and turning up wind...
Actually, no. A colleague, Neil Vickers, published a very interesting paper in Nature several years ago where he could take a moth, and they have these big, long antennae. He would clip the antenna off of a different moth, glue it to the head of the moth he's going to fly in the wind tunnel, and then using a long tether, he could make electroantennagram recordings, so he knew exactly when an odor was hitting that moth. And he was able to correlate the occurrence of these upwind surges, crosswind casting, with the electrical signals that he could measure with that antenna glued to the moth's head.
I have followed one. You can just color the odor and just see it.
I think you could. You can put titanium chloride. You can put humid air. And there are various ways of visualizing it.
You can. I think Massimo is the one who should really be talking to specialists. I think the specialists get it all wrong, right? This, I don't know if you wanted to say it. We had this discussion yesterday. If you put color in there, you're just looking at the air, right? Not the individual particles. There's such low concentration, the real particles.
I think it's not as trivial to do or easy to do as it might sound.
For me, it sounds impossible. Actually, we've talked about it. I think I'm hoping to pick Massimo's brain there.
I mean, the easier thing to do is what my colleague did, is actually glue another antenna on and record from the antenna.
And then
know
the spatial
when
distribution that gives you the instantaneous position of the mark, which is useful.
Right.
Well,
people who study pheromones of pest insects did these studies back in the 70s and 80s. Where they would put a pheromone out in the field, downwind, and then they'd go 20 meters downwind, and they'd put up an array of about 300 moths in cages. Mm-hmm. And these male moths, whenever they get the pheromone, they'll start to flap their wings. So they could see which moths over here were flapping their wings and they weren't over here, so they could get some idea of the spatial structure at that
point. People do this with antennae now, because people are putting grids in antennae.
Well, I saw pictures of these guys doing it with hundreds of moths, and it looks like a religious ceremony of some kind. But they did indirectly get at this question of structure.
There's no unanimity there. They each flat a different
Yeah, could be.
Are there any odorants in autophorus?
Pardon?
Are there any odorants in autophorus? Because if there is, then you could try to get an autophorus.
This is in gas phase, right?
Yeah, I don't know.
Just wondering.
Alexa, you have
one thing we could discuss. This is actually very interesting.
I was wondering, since you mentioned evolutionary origin, I mean, fish also has lamina, similar structure of active system.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if, like in water, you can also see, I mean, water is probably much more lamina than air, so it should be much more stable.
Yella Atoma's done that in lobsters, looking at how they orient to a plume. I don't know how much he's visualized it, though. I'd have to be careful about that statement. But yeah, people have done that.
But it's not laminar, I think Mark Willis is right.
It's air is not laminar, no. But if you construct, you can construct a wind tunnel with baffles and make it really laminar. And even though the moth is still detecting the odor, because you're screwing up the turbulence, the moth has a much harder time finding the source because it's so used to using the turbulence to do it. Is that ingrained in the moth?
This was an experiment on nature, but they...
Yes, exactly.
I have one question on custom. I'm always bothered by this word because search is very well defined. Mm-hmm. You get something, you go after. Casting is a word that encompasses many things. So
right.
How do you go crosswind? How far you go crosswind? How extended is crosswind? How much do you go downwind? Has anybody characterized casting?
People were asking those kinds of questions a long time ago. I don't know the extent that anybody's working on it right now. So you have people were speculating that there's this sort of internal turn generator.
That's right.
And a timer. You link that up to a timer and you can explain a lot of this behavior. But I don't know the extent to which anybody's working on that or have really established that right now.
Give the statistics, for example. Mm-hmm. Does the history of detections affect the way they cast them?
So what it detected half a second ago affects what it will do when it encounters a filament right now. That I don't know. That would be a very interesting kind of a question to ask. So
I was actually visiting Neil Biggers, and he showed me some data that just, you know, unpublished kind of pile data that there was a moth who had, there was wind started coming in irregularly, and the moth was adapting its casting to it. So it seemed, it actually, and he was saying, this is not something that anyone's really studied. Mm-hmm. In the field,
adapting to
suddenly new turbulence and adapting, you know, how it was casting.
But not to the odors, to the wind.
It was to the wind.
Yeah, they adapt to odors also. So there's short-term adaptation mm-hmm. to odors that can affect this, that can last seconds if they get a strong, frequent stimulation, and that's been shown in a wind tunnel. But nobody's tried to put it all together, as far as I know, in the way you're asking.
Mm-hmm. So, there's a beautiful paper from Michael Dickinson on Joseph Lavoie.
But it's extremely short distance and it's not casting. So it's sure. Not characterizing casting. So as far as
was that in his opto chamber?
Mm-hmm. It's 1 meter.
But my impression was, I mean, that there's a lot of potential learning and plasticity going on, and it hasn't really been studied.
I mean, what's a pheromone? A pheromone is an unconditioned stimulus.
Right.
And what happens to unconditioned stimuli when you present it? They habituate. And you can get them to habituate to pheromones, and that affects how they respond in a wind tunnel. But no one's really put it all together in the way that you're asking. I think it's a really fascinating approach.
I mean, do you know, has anybody tried to make the chemotax, you know, search for its water source in the dark? Like, do they use visual cues at all?
This moth is Manduca sexta. It's a crepuscular moth, meaning it flies right at sunset and into the dark. And in the southwest deserts, it visits a flower at night called datura, which has a large white. I mean, it doesn't have a lot of color to it because it's at night. So the moth is not using, as far as anybody knows, as far as I know, visual stimuli. But if you stand downwind from a field of these datura flowers, you'll find these moths are flying past you upwind, apparently locating at night these flowers solely by olfaction, as far as I can tell. I don't think they have infrared. And there's very little light, but I don't know if they can see heat. They can also detect carbon dioxide, so they're orienting to carbon dioxide. Flower that's actively producing nectar gives off CO2, and that's why insects can detect CO2 many times.
I'm asking is because of casting behavior, I mean, how does it know where to come back to?
Well, if you're flying at a particular speed, and this is the question, right? If you're flying at a certain speed, and you have a certain rate of turn, and you have a short-term memory for your most recent speed and rate of turning, you can get some kind of information about your position. So if I turn left last time flying at this speed for this length of time, I'm going to turn right to counter that, right? That's total conjecture as far as I know.
And the question is how much of the history of detections is entering.
Right.
Decision.
You're also going to hear from Massimo that you guys must all know about infotaxis, right? Mm-hmm. Easy physics people telling me. Massimo, can you look this all up? So I think you're going to talk about that maybe when we
leave this, right? What was it?
Infotaxis.
Infotaxis.
Yeah, there's this paper in Nature. I mean, if you didn't know it, you certainly should know that Massimo and Boris Schreiman have this idea. Yeah, anyway, you should keep it all.
Yeah, that I would like to, yeah.
I think because in the end, it's quantifiers.
So just to, I don't think it would, because it's more for computers and robots.
Okay.
But it gets from the other side,
So, this, oh, another one?
One last really simple question. If you had the same moth do that over and over again, will it eventually just make a straight line to
no.
the,
no?
Okay.
No.
That's an interesting question. Yeah,
that may, it just, all there's always turbulence, and turbulence is different from one time to the next.
Did you get rid of turbulence?
It's going to have a hard time without the turbulence, but.
But if it's a learned situation, if you've got lots of landmarks, and so it knows.
Well, if it has visual landmarks, yes, it can do that, but it doesn't have them here.
Right.
That's part of what I was going to get to the vision.
Right. You need to have visual landmarks on the floor for the moth to fly. It needs a reference to know it's flying and has some speed. But there's no visual landmarks that pinpoint the source in these experiments. Okay, well, I'm 10% through my talk. It's okay, it's all right, actually, I'm having fun. I hope you are having fun, too. So it's not just turbulence in this statistical structure of your environment, but if I could actually put a color onto odors like you want, and this is false color, you might have a moth flying up trying to locate the green odor here, but somewhere behind it and around it is another odor source, a background odor source, also emitting an odor, and the filaments of the purple background are mixing with the green foreground, and if you presume an animal can pick out both of these odors with its sensory apparatus, you have the potential confound of this background odor. So if the animal's averaging the odor input over anything more than a few milliseconds, it might average background with foreground and run into this confound. And this is the natural situation. So I was, a few years ago, we had a fellow, Walter Leal, at Arizona State University give a talk. Walter works with all the steps that are involved in sensory transduction, getting the ligand to the sensory receptor. I'll show you all those steps in a second. Well, let me just show you right now. First thing is you have a boundary layer surrounding any fixed structure in an airstream, a layer of dead air, I presume. And if you look at the bees, a cross-section of the bee's antennae, they don't have sensory hairs with the olfactory receptors in it. They have what are called plates, pore plates, that are presumably sitting well below this boundary layer. So the first thing an odor ligand has to do when it hits the boundary layer is diffuse, presumably via Brownian motion, to, and this shows a hair, it would be a plate in the bee, to a sensory structure. And if you look at the cross-section of these hairs, there are all these, you can tell a sensory hair or a honeybee pore plate on an EM. Because they have a lot of tiny little holes in it where the sensillum lymph, equivalent to the mucus layer in our noses, is exposed to the air interface. So these odor ligands have to get across the boundary layer, get to one of these pores in this sensillum lymph, because it's, of course, a hydrophobic ligand, and has to get across this aqueous interface, and it can't do that. You have these large proteins called odorant binding proteins that are densely packed here in the sensillum lymph. And they sit here at this interface and latch on to these ligands and then somehow serve to transport the ligands to the dendrites where the pH changes, I think, from low to high as you get out here from the periphery to the dendrite. The pH causes a conformational change in the large protein, so it's much easier for it to release the ligand when it gets to the receptor at the surface. So you have a sequence of steps that have to happen for this ligand to get to the receptor and initiate a depolarization. And in the middle of the talk, I asked Walter, because I always wondered this, how long does that process take? And he said, well, nobody knows, but people think it's on the order of about 30 to 50 milliseconds. Well, something I'm not going to have time to show you today is when we record four synapses into the bee brain, the output of the mushroom bodies, and that's several synapses with long conduction delays, we see the fastest latencies of about 90 milliseconds. And I thought, you can't be taking up that much time for this transduction. Furthermore, 40 milliseconds when the bee or the moth is only exposed to a filament for a few milliseconds is too slow. So we set out to measure it. And now I have to go through a sequence of steps because the people did this have these wonderful ways of showing all the different steps with the ligand being released now and binding. And we wanted to estimate, well, how long does this whole process take? First thing we had to do was measure when the odor comes out of the valve and gets to a point where we're going to put the antenna. And this is an overlay of two images with a laser beam shooting down through this titanium chloride laced air from two different positions. And then we have a photodiode here that tells us when we start to pick up the reflected light coming from this laser. You see here's valve opening, it's noisy. And a few milliseconds after valve opening, you start to record, because we're recording here this is the photodiode response. So we know how long once the valve opens, we know when the odor gets to the position where we're going to put the antenna, right? So we eliminate that as a source of variance, right when that ligand hits that boundary layer. So if now we record electroantennograms and we put the antenna at one of these positions, here's the same trace I just showed you for the odor getting to the position of the antenna. We can measure the start of the electroantennogram signal, meaning you see electrical transduction taking place. And if you take the difference between the two, it comes out to about 1.4 milliseconds. Which is extremely fast to get a ligand through all those steps to the receptor to initiate depolarization that we can measure.
Exactly, is the reference that leads you to be surprised is only 1 millisecond.
The reference were all my colleagues telling me it must be 20 to 40 milliseconds.
This is just an absolute guess for a
colleague. On their part?
Yes.
Yes.
No, I cannot call your experiment guesswork. There is guesswork, but please don't be surprised. If you go to chemical kinetics textbooks, you see that this is not surprising.
Well, yeah.
You show these things, the full packing with OBP is very important. Because
that's right.
It's second order kinetics, because there is a divide of the ligand to the receptor. The more receptor, even if the ligand is a very small amount, it will work much faster. Faster and more effective in terms of thinning. And then the diffusion is very fast.
Right. Basically. So, well, we did some back of the end. We did exactly like, we were surprised that so many people were surprised, but I was pleased because this got into PNAS because everybody was surprised.
It's good that you weren't a reviewer.
Exactly, right. Yeah. I said, don't send this to Doran, whatever you do.
I won't be surprised.
But we did the back of the envelope calculations. You do the
calculations, or this was just top of the head.
Well, they were saying top of the head because they were using electrophysiology, and you get this big artifact when you start doing electrophysiology. Furthermore, when you record from single cells, you know, out of a population of 50,000 cells, some of them are going to respond really, really fast. That might be a small fraction of them. Some will respond at 40, some at 60, some at 80 because of the ligand binding to the binding pocket is not so optimal for some reason. And if you just start recording from 20 of those cells at random, your chances of getting the really fast ones are very low. So we do with EAGs, so we see the signal from all the cells. And that's why I say you should do this kind of thing with EAGs. So it's fast. If you want to know behaviorally how fast can it be, this is my colleague, Paul Zyska, who was also our collaborator on that previous study. He trained honeybees to You can train them to two odors. You label them H and N simultaneously or synchronously, and then do something similar to what I was describing a few minutes ago. You can then ask them, what did they learn about H or what did they learn about N when they're simultaneous? And this is all the EAG stuff, but coming over here, this is the amount that they will respond to odor A when suddenly you mix it with odor B during testing. Response goes down. If I have as little as a 6 millisecond delay between the off onset of A and B, and if it doesn't matter if it's odor A then B or B then A, suddenly the response goes up. So again, very consistent with what we're talking about with very fast sensory transduction, is the bees are able to make a discrimination of A from B with as little as a 6 or 7 millisecond onset differential.
Can you say something about how this pod physically works? Because the it's a G-protein coupled receptor.
No, it's an ionotropic receptor.
In the insect, it's ionotropic. That's how
yes.
It feeds so fast.
Well, someone told me, because there's some debate right now about is this really ionotropic or not. So let's say it is, then it makes the answer to your question easy, relatively easy, because it's going to be a faster mechanism than a G protein linked receptor. Let's say some of the cons who are saying no, there's still G protein coupled. Let's say they win. Then how do we explain this? The one way I can explain it is, and I don't know that anybody's done this study in vivo, is if you have sensory receptors that are sitting there with membrane potentials that are just right below activation, right? Then they're sitting on the border of instability. And you do see fairly high background firing rates in these sensory receptors when you record from them. Now, that could be due to damage or any other things. But if these things are sitting there at the edge of instability, then getting them to fire really fast is possible, even if it's G protein coupled.
It would be noisy as hell, the response.
They would have to be noisy, yeah.
Well, no, the response itself would also be noisy then, because you can get fluctuating.
That's right.
Crossing all the time, so.
And I'm just speculating wildly.
The antennagram looks beautiful, right? I mean, it's just, on average, it's just no zero noise.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty easy, straightforward to do. Well, if you have people like Powell in your lab. Well, I don't know if it would work. It's just pure speculation. I've had these conversations because people would say, well, now you proved it is ionotropic. And I would say that wasn't our point, but maybe.
But there's nothing simple in this, in the B system to use like pertussis or something or the G beta S to inactivate.
Sure. Yeah. Has it been done? No, I don't think people have done it. Well, the papers a few years ago in Nature, there were two papers in Nature, one from Leslie Vossall and colleagues, and the other from Bill Hansen, where they both identified these receptors as being strongly ionotropic. Bill's group said, no, there's still a G protein coupled component to it. And Leslie said, no. So that's the debate right now.
And other invertebrates? Is there, I mean, besides insects? Is it ionotropic in other groups?
That I don't know. Say in other arthropods like lobsters. There are two types of receptors, ORs and IRs, in insects. And both, as I understand it, are ionotropic. But I don't know for right off the top of my head for lobsters where it's been looked at, Bariaki and some of the other people, what they've identified.
Or arachnids. Or
arachnids.
Yeah.
So, I hope I've convinced you that this whole thing is fast. Let me quickly, if I may, and Venki, I still have 10 minutes, you promised me. let me talk about another source of variation. And that's the variation from one object to the next. And this is something that I'd like to stand here and say that, yes, when I started studying learning, I went back and read all of Pavlov's works, just like every evolutionary biologist has read all of Darwin, right? Yeah. And I'd be lying if I said that for either. But I did read some of Pavlov where he actually said a big problem in learning is that no object is ever the same twice, even under highly controlled circumstances. So the problem, if you think of the simplistic kind of learning rule that you get in a textbook, is A is associated with food, I'm looking for A next time. But even for a rat in a Skinner box, it might be a light in front of me this time, the next time the light's over here, the third time the light's back here. I still have to generalize and recognize that as the same stimulus in spite of that variance. When you get out into odor objects in the field, it becomes far more complex because, as you all know, these natural odors are more often than not mixtures of many different chemical components. And if you look at those components, you see a lot of variation. So one of the things we did with a colleague, Natalia Dudareva, is we analyzed the chemical constituents of individual snapdragon flowers. And we're just looking at six of the, it's more complex than six, but we just looked at six of the major components. And individual flowers, if you plot them now, of course it's six-dimensional space, which we reduced to two, so I can project it here for you. Using principal components, this is one genetic variety of snapdragon flower. All of the light-colored dots are individual flowers, so you see considerable variation. And you can train bees to discriminate this from this, so it's detectable to the bees. This is a different genetic variety of the same species here projecting on a combination of the first and the second component, right? See a lot of variation. What you're seeing is not a single type of flower. You're seeing clouds of points. These big, I don't know if I'll have time to talk about this, these are synthetic mixtures that we've made up to span this variation in both of these clouds, and we do a lot of our training now with synthetic, pardon?
So far.
Six different chemical components, yeah. I'll show them to you if I, well, I only have 8 minutes, but I can show them to you at some point if you want to see more. So you think, well, how does a bee solve that problem? How does any animal solve that kind of problem? And there's a great paper by, I think it's Roger Shepard, 1987 or 88, Science on the Generalization Problem. If you really want to read a very interesting paper that set me on this path. Well, one way to do it is you calculate the mean of those centroids, and you start looking for the mean value. Bee's going to make a lot of mistakes by rejecting a lot of flowers that still have nectar, right? But it might stay within this cloud of points. And is this a realistic problem? Well, one thing that happens when a flower gets pollinated by a bee, it stops giving nectar and it slightly changes the odor. So this could be a realistic problem of nectar, no nectar, that a bee in a field of flowers has to make these decisions. Well, you could calculate the centroid, or you could incorporate not just the mean, but some concept of the variance. So now it's not anything near this point, but anything within these boundaries I'm going to call the same, and anything within these boundaries or outside of these boundaries I'll say is different. Furthermore, you might want to adjust these boundaries depending on how variable those cloud of points are or on how desperate you are to find food. So lots of different ways of doing that. So it's not just the mean. We have to have a concept. When I said statistical structure of the real world, I meant this kind of statistical structure, at least getting some kind of estimate of a second-order statistic like variance of the objects that are out there. And of course, if you get in the visual system, pixel by pixel, they don't talk just about variance. They talk about skewness, kurtosis, third, fourth order statistics that we really haven't approached in olfaction yet. It's an area that I'm very interested in getting into and trying to understand the statistical structure of the space, because I think we really need to do it when we start understanding, well, why is the olfactory system organized the way it is? And I will argue that this is an important function of early plasticity that we see in the antennal lobe. And I just want to go through one set of studies really quickly to show you the plasticity is there. And we do this with imaging. We can image these glomeruli, calcium imaging. We can image these projection neurons that innervate the glomeruli on the dorsal surface about 20 or so of the 160 glomeruli, project that onto a microscope, and then what you see when the odor comes on is you see a lot of activity that's not just spatial, but you see these temporal components here as well that are still ongoing after the odor goes off. Now, we can use this temporal information, and this is these are the pure odor 9-1. I showed you the behavioral data a little bit ago. 9-1, 7-3, 5-5, 3-7, 1-9, and then other pure odor. So we go through pure odor and one through various mixtures to the other. We can take and make 100 millisecond snapshots of that activity and draw these trajectories. So this is one pure odor, this is the other, and this is 9-1, 7-3, 5-5, 3-7, 1-9, 0-10. So it just steps right across. That's the perceptual dimension as encoded in the antennal lobe across these 20 glomeruli, which I was surprised it was so nice and linear, that there wasn't anything nonlinear happening. I think Ramon was disappointed when I showed him, because he wants things to be nonlinear. But anyway, but it turned out to be very interesting when we now have two groups of bees, a naive group and a group that we're going to condition, 9-1 plus versus 1-9 minus, the behavioral data from an hour ago. And we perform the same experiment now in the conditioned and the naive animals, and we can point by point calculate the Euclidean distance between those trajectories as they evolve apart. And what you see, and these are just populations and these are individuals to show you that individuals reflect the average bee population, and what you see is that here's the distance in the naive animals, it's the open circles, the odor comes on, 100 or 200 milliseconds later, you start to see the response in the projection neurons, and the odor goes off and it relaxes back to baseline. In the bees that have been conditioned to discriminate, what happens is they move farther apart.
But what between what trajectories?
Pardon?
Between what? It's the distance between two trajectories.
The distance, the point-by-point distance. At 100 milliseconds, what's the difference? What's the Euclidean distance? At 200, at 300? Between the 9-1 and the 1-9 trajectories.
Is that done in this reduced space or in the original space?
It's done in the original space. The Euclidean distance is done in the original space because we didn't want to lose the information from 20 dimensions. So this is calculated from 20-dimensional space. I have, obviously, it's hard to show you the 20-dimensional space here.
It's essentially because the stress, the signals are longer lasting or stronger. I mean, the shapes are kind of the same, right? So.
Well, what happens is they just, there are, and if you do, if you look at this.
So then you're getting a greater calcium signal.
Well, this is a calcium signal, so the relationship between signal to spike, I assume there's some there. There's more spikes when we get more calcium, but that's not a perfectly mappable relationship. But
because the levels are just higher after.
Well, what you see, if you go through glomerulus by glomerulus, and you say, well, is it that some glomeruli are just shutting down? Nothing changes that dramatically, but some glomeruli get tweaked up a little bit, and some get tweaked down, and across 20 dimensions, you get these trajectories moving farther apart.
So tweaked up and tweaked down means less amplitude or more amplitude. Not longer duration of time.
There could be longer. We were looking more at amplitude because we wanted to ask that question as well, what's happening? Why are these things, these trajectories changing?
So can you see this difference after you normalize for the magnitude?
Yes.
Magnitude?
Yes, yes.
Two questions. So the axes of the plot are two particular chunks of glomeruli.
The axes for the plots are principal components. So we take 20 glomeruli, run it through the activity through principal components analysis, and come out with two factors that account for about 80% of the total variance. That's just to show you that the question before was when we calculate the Euclidean distance, it's in the full 20 dimensions.
Another question. In mice, I've read the receptor distribution can change with olfactory experience. Does that happen at all?
Yeah, I don't know. And that's certainly conceivable.
Has a bearing on your
It would certainly have a bearing. So we have to select bees from the field, and we can breed honeybees to be as genetically identical as they possibly can be. You can't inbreed them like you can mice or fruit flies. But we can control these factors as much as possible, age, genotype, experience, but we can't really account for that yet.
Or, so to go back to the beginning, this is your octopamine effect?
Yes. Oh, well, that's what I'm proposing is the octopamine effect. What we haven't done yet is gone in with double-stranded RNA against that octopamine receptor, which we have now, and we've shown we can knock it down. That affects the learning. The next step is to knock it down and see if we can collapse these trajectories that based on that. So I haven't really nailed it down to octopamine quite yet. That's the hypothesis, though.
So I remember that in the locus work on GL showed that you have also that transient, and if you have prolonged stimulation, the distance is then getting reduced.
Because it goes to a fixed point.
Yeah, exactly.
You go around these curves to a fixed point.
So which in your case it would not be so apparent, because I guess the red box or the gray box there represents the period of the stimulation.
The period of stimulation here is about a little over a second, so we terminate.
In the right slot, top right.
Oh, top right. Oh, yeah, it's going on. That's a thousand. That's a second.
So if you were to just prolong the stimulation there, you would also have the distance.
In the work from Gilles' lab, the fixed point usually occurs between a second and 2 seconds. So we stop the stimulation before we get to that fixed point.
So if you had those conditions of prolonged stimulation, would you observe the same thing in the
heat? I don't know. Possibly. I mean, the interesting thing would be, do they converge then on the same fixed point,
exactly,
or do they move apart at the fixed
point? The question here is that when you train, do you only have the effect during the transient, or do you also have observed?
Yeah, that I don't know. But remember, the decisions I just showed you are occurring down here, right, at 200 milliseconds, certainly by 500 milliseconds. That's not to... I mean, the fixed point is an interesting question that we haven't gotten to yet.
It would tell you something about the dynamics of the system. I mean,
I could show you some electrophysiology in a little bit that show the fixed points. So we do see them, but I'm not going to get to that unless you give me another 3 hours. So one point I made was that we've done quite a bit of modeling, Ramon, Maxime, and Christian Linster, where we've made some predictions that the most likely synapses to target to get this effect as well as the separation are the GABAergic synapses. And I showed you a little bit ago that, yes, we see the octopamine receptors primarily on the GABAergic interneurons. So that was a prediction we made with modeling from years ago that seems to be holding up.
You don't mean GABA receptors. You mean something about the GABA.
GABA on the GABAergic interneurons, right. No, sorry. Right, thank you. Last thing I'm going to go through very quickly is these were, I'm 3 minutes over, is that okay? Venky said he's going to get obnoxious here any second.
Yeah, I'm controlling myself.
Not for long.
So this is a binary mixture. And I just said, well, odors are natural mixtures, and we're making up these odors to mimic now natural variation. So now does the same thing happen in these natural situations? And the answer is, I'll flip through it very quickly. Doran, you were asking what are the components, and these are the individual components we talked about. And yes, the antennal lobe responds to all of them, so they're not just focusing on two. There's the data from all those six mixtures, and the antennal lobe can differentiate them. And if now I take those cloud of points and I calculate the pattern of activity across glomeruli that I see when we stay within the green cloud, it's pretty high, on average about 0.9. A correlation coefficient from one of those points to the other in the green cloud, it's about 0.9 from one point to the other in the green in the orange cloud. And if you go correlating between the two clouds, the correlations drop. Now, if we train bees...
It's still high.
Pardon? Oh, it's still high because these are very similar odors. Like I say, we've been trying to make this tough for the bees to do.
How do you get these numbers or the correlation?
Calculating the 20-dimensional correlation between glomeruli when they respond to one odor versus another within a cloud versus between.
At the time point or average over time would be different?
This is now averaged over time. Although I'd have, this is a paper we're just submitting, and I have to go back. I haven't read it in a while. I have to go back to the methods to answer that clearly. But now let's train orange plus versus green minus. And we're not going to train one odor across 15 or 20 trials. We're going to use six different odors each three or four different times. So we're teaching the bees not just about the odor, we're teaching them about the variance from trial to trial, okay? And what happens to those correlations? Well, what happens right here, first, within a cloud, the correlation goes down a little bit. Correlation goes down a little bit in the orange cloud, so the clouds are getting bigger, right? But the correlation between the clouds goes down a lot. So what's happening in this space with natural odors, it's doing the same thing I showed you with the binary mixtures a few minutes ago. Just now it's taking the two clouds and pushing them apart and spreading them out a little bit to help separate the space statistically for the bee.
If you present some other odor mixture also as a test, now what consequence does this have for the separation of other odor mixtures other than this?
Well, and that's an interesting question, because everyone would say, well, you disrupt this space and you're going to start screwing up with coding of other odors. We have used in this paper a different odor that's vastly different from any of these, and the bees don't respond to it very much at all. However, we haven't done the test that you're asking, say, how do they differentiate other odors in the space around it? The only answer, I have two answers. One, interesting question, and yes, we want to do it. Two, speculation. When you think, this is 160 odorant receptors, combinatorial coding, not even taking into consideration the spatiotemporal code. That's an enormous space, right? And how many odors does a bee have to detect at any point in time? How many odors do we have to detect at any point in time? Very few. Pardon? Well, chocolate. I saw you eating chocolate. It's very few. And if I'm they're very, very similar frequently, like I showed you. All I'm doing is I'm stretching a tiny little part of that space. But I'm guessing that space is so enormous that it's not going to be like a bunch of cue balls knocking everything around. That you can tweak one area of that space without affecting everything else.
I guess the reason I asked is that the knob you have are these inhibitory interneurons.
Right.
And so, but they are not specific for one odor or for one molecule or another molecule. So
right.
Their effect would be general if you really change their synaptic strengths. Unless somehow here there's some feedback coming back down.
That's the next half of this 8-hour talk. is getting into the mushroom bodies, and I would show you just to give you a 10-second synopsis. Is the antennal lobes makes these calculations over 200, 300 milliseconds, so it's evolving. The mushroom bodies, the output of the mushroom bodies, so these are 800 projection neurons inputting onto 170,000 Kenyan cells. That summarize everything, and then we measure what comes out simultaneous to what comes out of the antenna lobe. The antenna lobe is computing over 200 to 400 milliseconds. It's that nice rise, and then it slowly goes down. The mushroom bodies come on and come off and make the discrimination within about 90 to 100 milliseconds. So I always wondered, well, why does the antenna lobe go on thinking and computing when the mushroom bodies have already figured it out? Unless there's some kind of feedback, instructive feedback. It has to be there. Anatomically, the connections are there, but nobody has studied it yet. Anyway, thank you, everybody. I was only 9 minutes over, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm halfway through my talk.
Yeah,
I understand.
So, I mean, it's amazing stuff. I just want to play devil's advocate.
Pardon?
I want to play devil's advocate for once.
Okay.
they don't really create new information by that increasing the divergence of the trichotics. You still would be able to discriminate the smells on the basis of uninhibited or undiverged trajectories.
Yes.
Because the inhibitory neuron has no new information about those smells.
That's right. I'm not creating new, I'm taking an existing perceptual dimension. The way I think of it is this is a perceptual dimension. If you think of it like your example today, for light, which is easier for us to think about because it's wavelength, and if you think neurally, that's represented from here to here, and all I've done is take that perceptual dimension, and I'm stretching it a little bit so I make the discriminations along that dimension a little bit easier.
I don't know if that's good logic. I think it's just rephrasing what I said. Also, it's puzzling why you have to do it in the sensor end things. Why can't we just do this in the vision? Same thing. You don't change your photoreceptors, and you train cortex or higher classifier, right?
Well, yeah, but
so here
maybe there's something peculiar.
The camera, essentially. If it is what it is. But it just seems puzzling that you're sort of irrevocably changing something in the very front end.
That's right. So now the big question here. I keep saying the big question as though the last one wasn't big, and if I had to criticize myself, I mean professionally, not personally, but you know. Odor comes in and it's pattern A in a naive B, and that gets handed off to the mushroom bodies as pattern A. You get reinforcement and the mushroom bodies are listening to the same reinforcement signal. Now, the antennal lobe changes. The mushroom bodies have learned A. And this is the problem you're pointing out, is next time the odor comes in, it's no longer A, it's A prime. And how does the mushroom body generalize from A to A prime? That's why it's important, I think, that these changes I'm pointing out in the antennal lobe are small, so the generalizing from A to A prime is possible, but also, in some sense, that maybe I don't understand yet, that change early in processing has to help the mushroom bodies, maybe by taking off some kind of computational load, because in the bee, in contrast to the fly, you go up to the calyces of the mushroom bodies and you see the axons from these projection neurons will input one area, there'll be mechanosensory axons inputting into another area, there's all sorts of input coming directly from the visual neuropil into the mushroom body. So the mushroom body anatomically, and if you do the recordings from the output, you see reactions to all these different stimuli, but it's highly multimodal. So if you make this separation early in a way that the mushroom body can track, and the mushroom body is really worried about context and all these other kinds of issues. You know, it's a yellow flower, it's a blue flower, because the odor can mean very different things. And bees learn about textures of flowers. Bees are learning the spatial locations of flowers. And the mushroom body is very computationally involved in all those things. So why push all the computational responsibility off to the mushroom bodies and not sort of make the easier separation early?
I wouldn't be surprised if anybody asks why you developed biology. Biology is tinkering. Sometimes it happens like this, and sometimes it happens.
Then we should all be not studying it. Then we should all be taking the next thing. We just go home. That makes no sense.
I just want my competitors to not study it.
How is what was important?
For some people.
So I basically disagree with that sort of clarity.
I think the idea is a divide here that you just pointed out.
I would like my competitors to give up.
Yeah.
Okay, that would make my life a lot easier.
I don't want to cut short, but I think I just want to make one of you guys a question. So I think this has come up already twice, and I think Alexei and I agree with him. There's a point to be made about, we always think of separation being useful, but it's only true if you separate the signal without expanding the noise. If you're going to separate, and if everything kind of balloons, it's completely meaningless. And so I think we should have a discussion, maybe Ramon and whoever and these guys.
I really think
it's a topic we should go back. That's all I wanted to say. Lucia, sorry.
I just want to say, but in the mouse, isn't there this kind of talking back and forth between the olfactory bulb and the entorhinal cortex?
There's feedback from the hippocampus, there's feedback from the amygdala, there's all sorts of feedback back into the mouse.
So would that be homologous? I mean, similar to this, having the antennal lobe being on for longer than the mushroom body?
Well, I mean, there's precedence in the mammal for feedback really influencing what goes on in the bulb, for sure.
So is that what's going on?
Has not been studied in insects as much. Although anatomically, there are connections that imply it.
How do you know it's just on the unbinding time of molecules onto the receptors?
The unbinding time?
That you said the receptors stay on longer than the response time in the mushroom.
But these are principal cells, right? Not that. What's prolonging in your case? What is the signal that's prolonging?
What's prolonging? Well, You mean in terms of separation?
No, no, you said the signal is prolonged past the decisions made.
Oh, if you measure the activity of the antennal lobe, this is the output of the projection neurons. And what happens is when the odor shuts off, you still see some activity that will go on for up to...
But that's not present in the ORNs. I think that's what David's point. Is it just ORN persisting activity passed on?
Or that I don't know. That I don't know if it's persistent ORN activity, but I doubt it. I think it's more intrinsic activity of the network, but I don't know.
Well, if you pumped on a different odor, to compete off the present molecules that are bound, did the response change?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I deleted that slide because it was too much. That in the middle of it, even in the middle of a presentation, if you shut an odor off and you would get this trajectory. You turn on another odor and it takes off from there and heads off on a trajectory that's a little bit different but somewhat similar to the one it would take to that new odor.
So it averages or?
I'm not sure I would call it averaging.
But I mean, there's a contextual effect, a historical effect.
Yeah, there's a historical effect of when I switch off A and immediately turn on B, the response to B will be reminiscent of B but slightly different and dependent on the recent history of A.
Cool. All right, we should keep talking because it's very exciting, obviously, but I think...
Well, thank you, everybody.